Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Secret Service scandal in the news this week, flare-up in Afghanistan, and tough nose-to-nose campaigning for the presidency. Three Secret Service men out, 11 in trouble after a night with prostitutes in Cartagena. Republican Congressman Peter King of New York said the president could have been endangered.
This could have had dire consequences. So far, it does not appear as if the national security or the president's security was compromised. However, this could have been a disaster.
Tough fighting in Afghanistan, and new photos emerge of U.S. soldiers mugging by dead bodies. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta condemned the images.
That behavior that was depicted in those photos absolutely violates both our regulations and, more importantly, our core values.
And Dick Clark, longtime host of American Bandstand and Times Square New Year's Eve, signs off at 82.
The weird thing about it is you can hear a happy song and it could have been a memory of one of the worst times of your life. Music really is one of the three most important things in our life.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with A.B. Stoddard of The Hill, Yoshi Driesen of National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What are you thinking on the Secret Service and Colombian prostitutes on Afghanistan? What's your top story this week? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is A.B. Stoddard, associate editor and columnist for The Hill. A.B., great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be with you.
And from Washington, Yoshi Driesen. He covers military affairs and national security for the National Journal. Yoshi, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Nice to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Yoshi, and A.B.
So here's what the President of the United States had to talk about this week after going down for that summit in Cartagena, Colombia.
If it turns out that some of the allegations that have been made in the press are confirmed, then, of course, I'll be angry, because my attitude with respect to the Secret Service personnel is no different than what I expect out of my delegation that's sitting here. We're representing the people of the United States.
The United States Secret Service responsible for the security of the President of the United States and much more, all over the world's press and headlines for a night of prostitutes in Colombia just before the president arrived. Could it have endangered him? What does it mean about the Secret Service? Here's Utah Congressman Republican Jason Chaffetz. He was on NBC's Andrea Mitchell Reports on Tuesday talking about the scandal and its implications for the president's safety.
If you have Secret Service agents there and they've had their room compromised, you've had guests in your room, let alone prostitutes, they have ammunition, they have weapons, they have credentialing, they know where the president's coming and going, which doors he might be going through. To suggest so quickly the president was never in danger, how do they make such a swift statement? I think that begs even more questions.
Three out. We haven't heard the last of this. Yoshi Driesen, what does this tell us about the people who are around the president and responsible for his security? Is this some new kind of, lapse in the subculture there? Is there an ongoing problem here? What's going on?
Yeah, to be honest, I think we really need to be careful in cases like this, or frankly, similar cases with the military, to not take 11 guys who may have just been stupid or careless, potentially both, and try to generalize to the entire Secret Service, especially to the presidential protection parts of that Secret Service, who are really the elite of the elite. What it suggests about these guys is that they were careless, that they were drunk, that they were willing to cheat on their wives. The president, I think, may well have been in minor danger. I mean, these were not the guys who ride with him. These are not the guys who are right around him. These are more of an advanced team. So you can make the case, if you really sort of spin out all the worst case scenarios, that maybe, just maybe, this would have endangered him. I think the stronger case is these guys were careless. They don't deserve their jobs. They don't deserve their clearances. As far as we know, there's no evidence whatsoever that this is a systematic systemic institutional problem with the Secret Service.
A.B. Stoddard, do you think it's going to go down that cleanly in Washington? I mean, after all, this was on the eve of the president's arrival. They may not have been the people right around him, but how do we now have confidence that those right around him don't have the same kind of, what appears from the outside anyway, cavalier attitude, to say the least, about their role?
Well, I think, you know, he's right that we have to honor the fact that most of these public servants are giving most of their lives to their jobs. They are in the top echelon of our presidential security system, and they take their job very seriously, spending most of their time working working out in the gym or sleeping, and they give.
So what does that mean, AB? So boys will be boys. They need some time off.
I'm saying that we really can't say right off the bat that the people on the presidential detail are going to be possibly doing this too. Everyone in the Secret Service will now be under greater scrutiny. Perhaps it is possible that these prostitutes could have been part of an al-Qaeda ring, and absolutely the president's security could have been compromised. Weapons, computers, everything. However,
I mean, that's pure speculation. You're not suggesting that's the case.
I'm saying it is possible. It is possible, but because this happened and it's not likely, there's no evidence that that was the case, I'm sure the entire agency will be under greater scrutiny. Every single unit, those close to the president and those not, from this day forward, and I am sure that the president will be better protected after this episode than he probably was before.
Well, one hopes, but Jack, I mean, I've heard nothing about any kind of connection like that. Apparently, they went out, sort of rounded up a dozen prostitutes, took them back to the hotel, and off we go. But what it runs into, Jack, first of all, I think, is a public impression of this as the ramrod, straight, you know, impeccably, unimpeachably devoted people around the president. And, you know, real fears for any president, and maybe this one in particular, at any time. You just don't want to see that kind of punkiness in the system.
You certainly don't. The author Ronald Kessler, who's been on our program a couple of times, mm-hmm. came out with a book on the Secret Service a couple of years ago, and he reprised it in an article yesterday. He ties this incident into a change, not so much in culture as in bureaucracy. He says that since 2003, when Secret Service was folded in, was really immured in the walls of Homeland Security, it has cut corners. Its budget has been cut, and the director, Mark Sullivan, a Bush-era appointee, has not spoken up, has not fought for the budget. And he points to slip-ups. For example, the Salahis just walked into that party at the White House a couple of years ago. Mm. He mentions a game at Oriole Stadium where there was no magnometer screening people coming in and out, nothing to pick up the metal. He points out they haven't come up, the Secret Service hasn't come up to the FBI standards on weaponry, lack of practice with weaponry, and on and on. And basically, he thinks this corner cutting in the institution has created a culture where somehow agents feel free to disregard the rules governing their personal conduct.
Well, we don't like to hear it, and it's hard to know exactly what to make of it. Let's hear from our listeners. Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. David's calling. David, you're on the air.
Since the beginning of time, humans have prostituted themselves to those who would use prostitutes. And the world is still going on, and it will go on far long after this way overblown incident.
Point taken, but these are the people right around the president to secure his safety. Does that make it different, David?
I don't think so.
Let me go. Got it. Too much attention to it. Rich in Stanton, Virginia. What do you say, Rich?
I don't believe this is a budget issue. This is a personal matter of integrity. I can understand an individual, singular person making a bad mistake, but collectively, they should have critiqued each other, they should have made a wise decision, they should be collectively smarter than what they've done. This is personal integrity, and it should demonstrate to everybody, whether they're working for the president or working for a small business, they must have integrity all the time.
You'd sure like to see more of it in the people around the president. No question about that. A.B. Stoddard, what do you think happens with this? Is this a one-week story? He was in Colombia, he's back, he's fine, it goes away? Or does this somehow give the president trouble going forward?
Well, as I said before, I think that unless the investigation uncovers more wrongdoing, other bad behavior on other trips. I do believe advanced teams who head there before a trip, all the way up to people guarding the president, you know, at every second of every event, are going to be under greater scrutiny as a result of this occurrence. And I imagine that security will be tightened and people's security clearances will be reviewed. Their behavior will be more closely watched. I don't want to believe we have to spend more taxpayer dollars babysitting Secret Service agents, but I imagine that they will be under more monitoring than they have before. And the people who have compromised the Secret Service obviously are going to lose their security clearances and won't be part of the effort anymore or the agency. But I think that there is probably a benefit to this, that we will see a stricter, more closely guarded Secret Service as a result.
Everybody wants to see that security good and tight. I mean, you've got all kinds of comments out there that make you sort of have your antenna up. Here was a set from aging rocker Ted Nugent this week. Got a lot of attention, speaking out while at a National Rifle Association conference on Saturday. Just ripping.
Our president and attorney general, our vice president, Hillary Clinton, they're criminals. They're criminals. And if you take that adamant, we the people defiance, remember we're Americans because we defied the king. We didn't negotiate and compromise with the king. We defied the emperors. We are patriots. We are braveheart. We need to ride into that battlefield and chop their heads off in November. Any questions?
Ted Nugent, good heavens. Secret Service has talked with him since then. They're criminals. Chop their heads off. Jack, is this the tenor of the campaign season we're headed into, or just one nutty guy?
Oh, let's hope it's just one unprecedentedly nutty guy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, Secret Service scandal in Cartagena, Colombia this week. Bad photos and fighting season in Afghanistan. Obama and Romney square off neck and neck in Ohio and beyond this week. A.B. Stoddard is with us from The Hill, joins us from Washington, D.C. Yoki Driessen is with us from The National Journal, senior correspondent covering military affairs and national security there. Jack Beatty's here. A lot of talk this week about withdrawal timetables from Afghanistan, but we saw an offensive, a sort of spring offensive from the Taliban. Here's a sound, brazen attacks on Western embassies, the parliament, NATO headquarters. Afghan-led security forces finally overtook the Taliban in Kabul on Sunday. Here's some sound from that offensive. Yoki Driessen in Washington. I mean, the photos that came out of the 82nd Airborne with body parts from a couple of years ago, we should say, but even so, kind of overtook the news of this offensive last weekend. But what did we see in the Taliban, or was it Al-Qaeda, or was it both, launching all around the country pretty sophisticated attacks as we're supposed to be winding down or something here, Yogi?
Yeah, and I don't think those two are unconnected. The group that carried out the attacks was actually neither the Taliban nor Al-Qaeda. It was a group called the Haqqani Network, which operates in eastern Afghanistan from bases along the border, both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. This is a group that is very battle-hardened. This is a group that has shown no willingness whatsoever to engage in peace talks with the U.S. or with the Afghan government. And they're the group that are now the main U.S. battlefield adversary. And what you're seeing, I think, is two things. In terms of the photos, you're seeing, to my mind, a somewhat disturbing lack of accountability within the military. Not that there should be a rush to prosecute these guys, a rush to court-martial them, but at a minimum, a rush to discipline or to relieve from command the officers and non-commissioned officers who ran this unit, who ran the unit that burned Qurans, who ran the unit of Marines that urinated on the bodies of dead Taliban. In terms of the offensive, I think what you're seeing is the fact that everyone there, from the government of Afghanistan to the U.S., to the Haqqanis, to the Taliban, they're all preparing for next year. I mean, next year is when we have said that we will wind down our combat mission. By the end of 2014, we have said we'll basically have withdrawn from the country. And so the people fighting us are trying to figure out, they're sort of poking and prodding to see, can they accelerate the withdrawal? Can they make us leave sooner? Can they pull some sort of Tet Offensive, even in terms solely of perception, nowhere near the Tet Offensive in terms of casualties? But they know the wars are unpopular in Washington. They're unpopular throughout NATO. So they're trying to figure out, politically, can they get us out of there sooner?
So you see this as a PR poke, or is it a sign that you've got real resistance that, in the absence of NATO forces, might mean, a new Taliban takeover, or with Haqqani, even a new Al-Qaeda presence there?
You know, Tom, you ask a great question, and I think, frankly, the two can be very much linked. If you're Haqqani or the Taliban and you figure the Afghan forces remain fairly weak, you still have the ability to penetrate Kabul almost at will, and that's with the U.S. there, you will think, not unreasonably, that with the U.S. gone, it'll be easier for you to do those things. I mean, these enemies, we often like in this country to my mind, unfortunately, we underestimate them. They are very smart and they're very savvy. So if they look at it in terms of battlefield gains, they can fight hard, they can penetrate Kabul. That's with the U.S. So then their question becomes, how do you get the U.S. gone? And they understand politics. They understand that Americans are tired of the war, our European allies are tired of the war, and the more they can cause casualties, the more they can cause really embarrassing PR moves like this attack in Kabul, the quicker they can get us out, the quicker they can turn their attention to the much weaker Afghan forces.
Politics and a lot of gunfire. Let's hear from our listeners, John in Maynard, Massachusetts. John, thanks for calling.
Yes. I'd like to suggest peace talks with the Taliban. Ahmad Rashid suggested in his book, A Power-Sharing Agreement, he suggested giving the Taliban the South and to save Kabul. If we leave without a power agreement, we're going to have civil war there in Afghanistan, and the senior Taliban people would love to get back, and they want these talks. Pakistan's a problem. They don't want to have anything to upset their power.
So you're ready to divide the country, give up the South, so that things can go forward there. I mean, Jack, Americans are watching this with great interest. It's been a lot of years already, and attitudes continue to change, even as this thing rolls forward, not always pretty.
No, you mentioned attitudes. Even a majority of Republicans now want out and want out now. A poll released on Wednesday, Pew poll found that 59% of swing voters want, quote, rapid troop withdrawal. But Mitt Romney is more hawkish than President Obama on this, you know, so for the third time in my lifetime, during a war, war won't be on the ballot. In 1968 over Vietnam, in 2004 over Iraq, and now in 2012 over Afghanistan, the voters really aren't going to have a clear choice on an incumbent administration's war. You know, the president is only indirectly responsible for the economy, but he chose to escalate this war, to triple our forces in what many thought was an unwinnable and unnecessary war. And he's not going to feel the political heat for it in this election campaign, with Mitt Romney saying, "Your mistake in Afghanistan was you set a deadline for withdrawal." So, once again, we're not going to get a clear choice.
It's much or more. Here's Leon Panetta again apologizing for those photos, U.S. soldiers and body remains of Afghan insurgents.
This is not who we are, and it's certainly not who we represent when it comes to the great majority of men and women in uniform who are serving there. I expect that the matter will be fully investigated. That investigation has already begun. This is a matter that goes back, I believe, to 2010. But it needs to be fully investigated.
A.B. Stoddard, how do you see this playing out on Capitol Hill? Where does sentiment run there? Is there pressure for the U.S. to get out, or everybody's just hunkering down till after the election this fall? What's going on?
Well, it's so interesting. To Jack's point, the Republican Party is now so divided. The Republican Party was aligned with President Obama in staying in Afghanistan and bolstering our mission there with more forces. Now you see that party really divided and refusing to debate really what our next step is, how we've moved from the failure of a counterinsurgency campaign towards a more counterterrorism technique. We're running covert wars in Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan. We can no longer afford to invade and occupy. There's much concern about whether our efforts to train Afghan forces to sustain the country on its own is going to be successful. We have high numbers now in the 300,000s, but they're not an effective force by any matter. There's obviously, if it was effective, we wouldn't be negotiating with the Taliban. So there's such a split, because you see on the left a rush for the exits, and you used to see a commitment on the right, and that is disintegrating. And so with 6 in 10 Americans wanting us to leave, you see the president torn He did decide to triple down in Afghanistan, but at the same time he gave a withdrawal date. Now you see him pulling 30,000 troops out before his election. He hopes to be reelected. We're not leaving in 2014. We're not effectively gone in 2014. If you talk to anyone in the military and the national security experts who are dealing with this issue, they know we can't do that. We cannot leave and have the place taken over without some kind of cohesive political resolution, some kind of security, a sustainable security force there. And so we are going to stay there. But you're going to see the president take troops out to try to satisfy a war-weary public while trying to straddle this issue, because we can't send forces back into a country we've left. That is more painful than staying.
Yeah, and so there we are. One more call on this, and we'll go to campaign politics. John in Erie, Pennsylvania. Thanks for calling, John.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My biggest comment right now is the young paratrooper is holding the pictures of severed body parts. I don't understand the issue here. These are young men who we've trained to kill. And now that they're out taking pictures of this, everyone seems so shocked. This has happened throughout history, throughout time, in all wars. And we have to remember what we're putting these soldiers through, and to chastise them for dealing with their situation, I think it's a non-issue. I know Panetta is not a soldier. He's a politician, and he's just covering all the bases to appease all of the people.
Hey, John, you know, to be fair, the chain of command has expressed a deep concern about this as well. I think in part, John, because it makes the job harder for everybody else who's out there fighting. When you get that kind of mugging going on, the images get passed around in Afghanistan, suddenly they've got an angry population, and who couldn't understand that to deal with?
Well, that is true. But it's not like their propaganda is not putting out pictures of us as well.
Yeah, I mean, are we really going to sort of compete over who can hold up more, I don't know, heads or legs before a camera? But we got it, John, and I appreciate your call. Let's turn to the campaign trail. President Obama and Mitt Romney both in Ohio this week. Here was the president at the Lorain County Community College in Elyria, Ohio, emphasizing his support for America's middle class.
In this country, prosperity does not trickle down. Prosperity grows from the bottom up, and it grows from a strong middle class out.
And right behind him, Mitt Romney in Ohio, same county, criticizing President Obama's economic policies.
If you want to know where his vision leads, open your eyes, because we've been living it for the last 3 years. It leads to lost jobs, lost homes, lost dreams. It's time to end that vision and have a vision of growth and jobs and economic vitality.
Jack Beatty, there's Mitt Romney coming right back at Barack Obama. Of course, the factory behind him, the National Gypsum Factory, they're closed under President Bush. Nevertheless, he says, you know, it didn't reopen under this president. He's calling the president out on that.
He is, and today's New York Times gives him reason, I think, to hope. Shaky-looking recovery indeed, and some fear that the recovery is going to succumb, as the earlier ones did, 2010, 2011, to foreign events. And this is certainly going to help Mr. Romney. You know, throughout the primaries, people, pundits, kept saying, these primaries are really damaging Mr. Romney, his gaffes, his statements, you know, I like firing people, Etch-a-Sketch, all the rest. Well, the smoke has cleared, and I see the according to the Times poll, they're tied, 46-46. In a Gallup poll, tracking poll, Romney is actually ahead. And when you look at how symmetrical the race is, Obama's lead among women, 49-43, it really is offset by Romney's lead among men, the exact same percentages. It is going to be a very, very tight election, with so much really hinging on this economic picture, over which the president has very little control. And as people have pointed out, this is the quarter. This spring quarter is where people make their decisions on the economy now. Polls have shown this, that even a 1% increase in real income for people translates into a 5% increase in the vote for the president. Well, these jobs numbers, this picture, the psyche of the American consumer, the president's job is really on the line right now.
the president feeling the heat, and on Wednesday before a crowd in Ohio, talking about Americans working together to get great things done, but also getting what sounded like a little dig at Mitt Romney there right at the end.
That's how we built the Transcontinental Railroad. That's why we've got the best universities and colleges in the world. That's why we have cutting-edge research that takes place here, and that then gets translated into new jobs and new businesses because somebody did the groundwork. We created a foundation for those of us to prosper. Somebody gave me an education. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth.
He wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. On Fox News yesterday, Mitt Romney was asked to respond to that silver spoon comment, said it was time to stop personal attacks, start fixing the country's problems.
He's always looking for a scapegoat, particularly those that have been successful, like my dad. And I'm not going to rise to that. But this is a time for us to solve problems. This is not a time for us to be attacking people. We should be attacking problems. And if I'm president, I will stop the attack on fellow Americans. I'll stop the attack on people and start attacking the problems that have been looming over this country.
Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Tom. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think we need to look at some economic history in the sense it took Roosevelt 6 years to clean up Hoover's mess. It took Clinton basically 6 years to clean up the excess ballooning deficits of Reagan-Bush. It took Bush only roughly, 4 months to reverse Clinton with the first tax cut. And now we're surprised it's taken over 3 years to clean up Bush's mess. It reminds me of the Casablanca line of, I'm shocked, I'm shocked.
Mm.
Why should we be shocked?
Sounds like you're not shocked in Colombia. A.B., what do you see unfolding here as the president says, you know, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth and talks, collective effort, the things Americans have done together, and Mitt Romney talking economic freedom and let's not have personal attacks. Of course, there's Ted Nugent sounding pretty loud. What do you see, A.B.?
Well, I think that it is true the polls are tied. This is going to be a very tight race, one on the margins. I think that both candidates have real liabilities and other strengths. President Obama is actually, no matter what happens this quarter, going to be afforded credit for any evidence of a more robust recovery should we see, and I know it would be surprising, a different picture in the economy come August, September, October. Right now it doesn't look good for growth for the rest of this year. Right now it looks like his job is on the line because if the economy doesn't improve, people don't feel there's a durable recovery underway, he is going to lose his job because Mitt Romney is going to make a compelling case that he's a fixer, he's been in business, and he knows how to turn the economy around. At the same time, if it is doing better, there are persuadable, still open-minded swing voters who are going to be attracted to the message of economic fairness, who hated the bailouts, who think that the rich don't pay enough in taxes, that Mitt Romney is one of them. Mitt Romney supported TARP. That are going to listen if the economy is doing well to the president's message, perhaps in places like Ohio, where these working-class white voters will decide the election. That is not going to be the case for President Obama if the jobless numbers are terrible and the economy is sinking again.
Yohi Driesen, the polls say maybe a toss-up right now. Is that how it feels in Washington? Do you feel the two parties sort of looking at each other and saying, we've got an equal shot at this?
Among the people I talk to on the Hill, I'm up there fairly regularly, admittedly more often for national security stuff, among the Republicans I talk to, that's not the feeling I get. The feeling they have is that it's going to be extraordinarily hard for Romney to beat Obama. They do see paths where it could happen, to the point that they wonder about the sort of what a Romney loss would mean for control of the Senate, control of the House. I mean, yes, to AB's point, no one thinks it's going to be a blowout, but the people I talk to do feel very, very pessimistic about Romney's chances. You know, one point I want just to add from the clip you played of Obama with the silver spoon comment, the Romney equivalent, and, you know, for all of us talk about not personal tax, is to say Obama's an elitist because he went to Harvard, so did Mitt Romney.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, legendary University of Tennessee basketball coach Pat Summitt announced she'll step aside as winningest coach facing early onset Alzheimer's. She'll get the Medal of Freedom for her work with Tennessee's Lady Volunteers, the Lady Vols.
It has been a privilege to make an impact on the lives of 161 women who have worn the orange. I am so proud of them. The Lady Vol student athletes.
In Washington, crowds of people watched as the Space Shuttle Discovery took its last flight, piggybacked on a 747 before heading into the Smithsonian Institution.
Awesome!
Let me see.
Off she flies. And Levon Helm, the drummer and singer for the influential group The Band, died yesterday at the age of 71. He brought Southern soul to American rock.
Up on Cripple Creek, she sends me if I spring a leak. She mends me. I don't have the speed. She defends me. A drunkard's dream if I ever did see one.
We're looking at a week in the news. Secret Service scandal, bad photos, and fighting season in Afghanistan. Obama and Romney square off neck and neck in some of the latest polls. A.B. Stoddard is with us from The Hill. Yochi Driesen from the National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Ithaca, New York, and Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I think Obama has time to actually start educating the public. Things take a lot of time. Clinton had a great line. He said, it took a long time to get into this mess. It's going to take a long time to get out of it. And obviously he doesn't want to be constantly blaming Bush, but you know, stuff doesn't happen overnight. And the Republicans have obstructed him from day one. I mean, the so-called stimulus package was basically money to cities and states and counties to patch roads. It was pretty much, that was the long and short of it. And I would say we have not done anything that you could call true infrastructure in this country other than defense and aerospace since the interstate highway system.
Carl, we got it. You say give him time, and yet there's people out of work who may be listening to Mitt Romney saying, I've got another way, and may just hear something appealing in that. Let's get one from Nashville. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask real quick, is the strategy for Obama if he's going to speak to the voting population that's not typically the base that gets out and really votes? It seems if you look at the exit polls, the people that he's kind of pushing his agenda against are the majority of the voters, and he's kind of, it seems like, depending on a group of people who don't traditionally get out and vote.
Less affluent people, John? Do you mean poorer people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe so. Mm-hmm. You know, I vote, and I wouldn't call myself affluent, but I'm also part of the base that has not been all that satisfied with his performance as far as what he's promised in his campaign, but I'm still going to probably get out and vote. But it seems like he's speaking against a lot, if you look at the exit polls, of the people who actually get out and vote. And traditionally, it's been very difficult to get people that he's wanting to get out and vote and supporting his policies.
AB, what are you thinking on that front? The president clearly tilting toward, he says, middle class, and from the bottom up, Mitt Romney comes across, you know, differently, talks about job creators and is unapologetic about it. And John looks at who votes and wonders how this works for the president.
I think that caller makes a great point. The president is trying to get back the excitement among the very left of the base from 2008, his first-time voters. He's not going to get them all back. And he really needs to shift more after beating up on a do-nothing Congress all fall and then ever since the winter started going after this tax fairness argument. He really needs to pitch to something besides running on a platform of raising your taxes, to something more constructive and more positive about economic growth or debt reduction, because the voters want to hear what he's going to do in a second term. What would he promise? He's spending a lot of time these days on the campaign trail beating up on Republicans for their past policies of deregulation and tax breaks for the wealthy. And so he's not offering a positive enough vision for the caller and other voters like him, who are disappointed over the last 3 years and need a reason to vote for him again.
That is interesting. Of course, the Buffett rule the president pushed that would mean the rich paying at least 30% tax rate, million plus. On Monday, Senate Republicans voted down the Buffett rule. Here was Republican Senator Mitch McConnell critical of the plan, saying that the president had brought it up just for political motives.
President Obama looked at the options in front of him, sat down with his political advisors and said, you know what, let's go with a poll-tested tax increase on investment and job creation that won't fix anything and won't pass anyway.
Jack, can the president go after unfairness and taking care of the middle class and maybe even below a lot of people in that number and win?
He can, but I cited last week that poll from Third Way, which found that this is not what swing voters want to hear. They don't want to hear about fairness. They want to hear about growth. They want to hear about opportunity. And they don't accept the president's argument, which isn't made really with much vigor, that fairness is the key to growth. In other words, you've got to have folks toward the bottom having money to spend in order to make this economy work.
Of course, let's hear what our listeners have to say about money and where it flows. Paul in Quincy, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am wondering what your panel might think about the possibility of whether American companies will ever link pay to performance. The kickback from the Citibank stockholders, I guess, was somewhat historic, but it isn't binding on the board, so the board could still pay the CEO $15 million if they want to.
Yeah,
and I haven't seen anything in my lifetime, and I'm 54. Do American companies ever feel that they're going to be truly accountable, or do the people who run American companies ever feel that their pay will be linked to their performance? And if they have a bad year, they may just not get paid.
Well, let us pick it up, Paul. Of course, that was supposed to be the idea. That was big in when times were good, and profits were big and salaries went up and up and pay packages overall. Of course, this week, exactly, this came out of the Dodd-Frank bill. The say-on-pay part of that meant that shareholders could vote, and on Tuesday, 55% of Citigroup shareholders voted against a pay package that would have awarded the CEO there at Citigroup, Vikram Pandit, $14.9 million and maybe more. Now, it's not binding. We don't know where it's going to go. I'm sure, Jack, that corporations would say, well, we do tie it. But then, last year, Citigroup's shareholder return was down 44%, and they flunked the Federal Reserve's most recent bank stress test. It doesn't sound like a zillion. On the other hand, on the 14th hand, Vikram Pandit only earned $1 a year voluntarily for the last couple of years when things were tough.
Well, that's certainly true. But, the context of this is, while the average CEO pay increased something like 13.9% at the S&P 500 index companies in 2011, the S&P 500 index ended the year at the same level as it started. In other words, they weren't flatlined, which that would argue the same stock performance. They got a 13%, nearly 14% raise. And, of course, that brought them up. According to AFL-CIO's Executive Pay Watch, to the average Fortune 500 CEO now paid 380 times as much as the average worker.
Ron writes into us on Facebook, says, I forget sometimes that CEOs have access to alien technology that makes them hundreds of times more valuable than lowly humans. One bad side effect of this, he writes, is that when called before Congress or judges, they can't remember anything or don't know what's going on. Oof. Now, they're not the only ones who can't remember sometimes, though. Kind of scandal with the General Services Administration. GSA organized that 2010 conference, cost $800,000. On Monday, there was testimony before the House Oversight Government Reform Committee. Jeff Neely, the official who organized that conference, refused to answer questions himself, claiming his Fifth Amendment rights. Daryl Issa, Republican chairman of the committee, tried to get him to say something.
I must ask you once again to consider answering the questions. So, if you'll bear with me. Mr. Neely, what is your title at GSA?
Mr. Chairman, on the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my Fifth Amendment constitutional privilege.
Not even what his title was. Democrats went after him as well. Here's Elijah Cummings of Maryland, ranking Democrat on the committee, highly critical of Jeff Neely. He cites an email that Neely apparently sent to personal friends inviting them to the conference.
And this is simply incredible. Quote, we'll get you guys a room near us. We'll pick up the room tab. Could be a blast. Why not enjoy it while we have it and while we can? Ain't going to last forever. End of quote. Well, Mr. Neely, it stops now.
Ain't going to last forever. A.B. Stoddard, that attitude is just kind of incredible in this time. And did you learn from these hearings, A.B., how this microculture, forget the Secret Service for a minute. How did this grow up in a time of economic crisis that the GSA would be, hey, let the good times roll?
It really is stunning that people are not being watched, that bosses don't have bosses, and this kind of thing is not preventable. And it's a tough, this debate comes up time and again when these dramatic stories of waste come up. One side thinks that it's a rampant culture of waste and it's happening at every agency. Every bureaucrat is up to no good, spending the taxpayers' dollars, you know, buying trips to Hawaii if they want to. And then the other side says, oh, well, this is just an isolated incident. And it's obviously the truth is somewhere in between, but it's a headline grabber. Republicans on the Hill are having a great time right now because they're talking a lot about, you know, a bunch of embarrassing stories for the administration, this being one of them. But this is the kind of thing that has happened under Republicans and will happen under administrations to come from either party, and there needs to be more oversight in advance so that these things don't happen and we don't have to, you know, have these ghastly hearings and find out that $800,000 were spent on partying and hot tubs. It's unseemly and it's horrifying, but it's when it becomes a partisan football, it's kind of a joke. I mean, President Bush had a top domestic policy advisor in the West Wing advising him and earning a great salary, very close to the president, who went stealing radios at Target. I mean, it's not President Bush's fault. He didn't try to hire a guy who was mentally unstable, so it would end up with a criminal record. So it's, you know, they're embarrassing instances. It's hard to find evidence, though, that it's rampant everywhere. It needs to be, people need to be held accountable. And they need to take their job seriously, but I don't think it's fair when people are quick to judge that it's happening all over the place.
Fair enough. Just one more note on that. Here was the former GSA administrator who resigned after all this came out, Martha Johnson, saying she regretted all this. But listen at the very end what she really will mourn.
I am extremely aggrieved by the gall of a handful of people to misuse federal tax dollars, twist contracting rules, and defile the great name of the General Services Administration. I personally apologize to the American people. As the head of the agency, I am responsible. I deeply regret this. I will mourn for the rest of my life the loss of my appointment.
Martha Johnson in testimony this week. Yohei, help us look abroad for just a second here. We had a truce or something like it, maybe for a minute last week when we were talking here in Syria. Now we've got all kinds of allegations of new gunfire and attacks. Is it falling apart? Was it ever really there, Yohei?
I don't think it was ever really there. I mean, your question, I think, hit it about right, that this lasted about a minute. I mean, right up to the time that Kofi Annan was still in Syria, there was shelling in homes. Right after he left, the shelling resumed. This was not a real ceasefire. Assad clearly has no real intent to stop this assault across the country until he's crushed his opponents. What's interesting was some of the comments you heard yesterday. French President Nicolas Sarkozy referred to Assad as a liar. You had Hillary Clinton say that she wanted a Chapter 7 resolution, which would allow for the use of force in Syria. That was what allowed for the use of force in Libya. I don't think we're remotely close to that. I mean, the U.S. has no desire whatsoever, and the Pentagon makes this clear again and again, for any type of intervention militarily into Syria. But you are seeing the rest of the world come back basically to what you said at the outset, that this was a ceasefire that lasted about a minute, that it had no value whatsoever, and that Assad currently shows no inclination whatsoever to come to the negotiating table substantively or for real.
And President Sarkozy, of course, now fighting for his own political life back in France. Take us to Egypt for just a second, Yohei. The top candidates just kicked off the slate, I guess, by the remaining military power there. What does that mean for the race for the top spot in Egypt on this side of Tahrir Square?
You know, one of the interesting things that happened before they were kicked off was some of the people who actually came on. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood had promised since the uprising that toppled Mubarak that they were not going to field a presidential candidate. Then they did. Omar Suleiman, who had been a Mubarak aide for decades, had said he wasn't going to run. Then he did. These are both two of the people who may be kicked off the ballot. But you see this total, complete unsettling of what had been a very stable, enforced by force, regime in Egypt. And I think the reminder to all of us in the United States, we like to think that stories overseas have a sort of neat arc. Mm-hmm. There's a beginning, there's an end, and we know what that end point is. When there was this uprising in Tahrir Square, we felt like the Twitter generation, the Facebook generation had toppled this dictator, things were going to have a happy ending. flash forward, things have not had a happy ending. And the uprising and the protests, which are take place again in Tahrir Square, is a reminder of just that fact.
We will watch as Judy, writing into us on Facebook on another front, says the big story for me is the Vatican cracking down on U.S. nuns for focusing on the poor and economic injustice instead of abortion and gay marriage. We haven't heard the last of that one, Jack.
No, gosh, and how familiar that is. And, you know, that just the idea of the bishops looking at the nuns, I mean, that has been such a – the men monitoring the women. I mean, headlines would reveal that the men need some monitoring, too.
Once in a while. Yeah, I guess you're right on that. A.B. Stoddard, it's been great to have you with us today from The Hill, joining us, associate editor and columnist there. Thank you so much for your time and insights today, A.B.
Thank you.
And Yoki Driesen with the National Journal. Great to have you with us, Yoki. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Jack, have a good weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
And we'll go out with a little more from the great Lee Von Helm with the band, that rootsy rock sound, the Arkansas twang that he brought to some of the band's best work. He will be missed. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
My bag is sinking low, and I do believe it's time. Get yeah.